Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society. With me, science journalist Izzy Clark, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and the Society's deputy director, Dr. Robert Massey.
This is the place where Robert and I take on even more of your questions from the Supermassive mailbox, which has been inundated by so many of them that we just had to add these extra bonus episodes in between the main ones.
Okay, so Robert, let's start with this fun question from Peter Theophilus Bevis. They say, what will happen to all the stuff we are made of between now and the end of time? Is it possible, likely, improbable, or impossible that all the stuff the Earth is made of will eventually be smashed into bits and then used in the formation of different planets? Will the people on those planets still be finding our old nappies, Barbie dolls, enameled bathtubs, cut diamonds, and concrete bird baths?
Well, that's a sort of fun and slightly depressing question, isn't it? The idea. I mean, this would be the ultimate signature of alien life, wouldn't it? If we had space dolls on Earth.
Space nappies.
Civilization. What a thought. Yeah. So, no. I mean, look, okay. So it works at different levels, this. So you have to think back to, well, or forward to, rather, the fate of the solar system, first of all. And probably, maybe not, the Earth will get swallowed by the expanding sun as it swells up to become a red giant in 5 billion years and more in the future. And even before then, we'll have lost our atmosphere as it heats up. So the odds of most of our junk surviving is pretty low. And as you get closer to that point, even if the Earth isn't swallowed, then the surface is likely to be covered with lava. So all of that stuff is basically going to be destroyed. If you had some of that stuff in space, it would survive differently, but even plastics don't survive particularly well because they get exposed to radiation, they get broken down into bits, so they're not going to do well. Concrete might, but again, I'm not sure, running the clock forward billions of years, whether we have anything really that would be recognisable after so long. So in a sense, I suppose you could argue that the atoms from which this stuff is made, they would be the legacy. So if you have the outer atmosphere of the sun being dispersed in space, having swallowed the Earth, then bits of us will be indeed spread out among the stars, and some of that might just end up in new stars and planets. So philosophically, maybe just about. And if you consider it on the very long time scale, then there are ideas about whether matter itself breaks down, whether protons decay or not. Probably not from what I've read, but if it happens, it happens in 10 to 36 years, which has the wonderful name of an undecillion of years in the future, which I had to look up this morning to check how far away in the future it actually was.
That is amazing. And Becky, Chris Ryan has this question on black hole mergers. Hello everyone from Australia. I love the show and I've been reading Dr. Becky's book and have convinced the book club in my office to read it as our next monthly challenge. My question is, can the event horizon of a small black hole spaghettify as it approaches the event horizon of a larger black hole? Lots of love from down under, Chris. So can you start with spaghettification, please, Dr. Smethurst?
Yes, well, spaghettification is the idea. Well, it's also, first of all, my favourite word in the English language. Spaghettification. Let's just have another moment for it. Essentially, what this is when, if you approach a black hole, the strength of gravity, like the gradient of the strength of gravity, is so steep that it's so much stronger, say if you were falling feet first towards a black hole, it'd be so much stronger at your feet than at your head that you would get stretched out like spaghetti into this long, thin chain of atoms, essentially. And we see this happening to like stars if they get too close and they swoop round a black hole, they get stretched out by sort of like tidal forces, essentially. So, Chris, in response to your question about can this happen to event horizons, yes, but also no, not what you're thinking and not what you're picturing. So, like, an event horizon is not a real object, right? It's not a solid entity of any form, right? It is this boundary around whatever is, you know, the central mass of the black hole, whatever that happens to be, singularity, exotic matter, whatever it is. Is this boundary around it where you're no longer getting any light from? Now, that depends on the curvature of space itself, right? How Einstein tells us that mass curves space, right? And so at some point, the curvature gets so strong that, like, you know, light can't escape from it anymore. So as two black holes get closer together, the curvature of space changes around them. Like, you can picture it, you know, as having like two basketballs or two footballs on a trampoline, right? And then you, like, if you're moving them around, you can see how the trampoline is sort of constantly curving and uncurving as you move them. And so what happens as they get closer is that, like, the curvature of space changes, so almost like the event horizons reach out to each other and they sort of make like a dumbbell shape in a way, like a dicky bow kind of thing, you know. So in a way, they do get stretched, but it's not because of spaghettification. It's just because of the curvature of space around the two black holes changing.
That makes sense.
So yes and no, because it kind of looks like spaghettification, but it's actually two different effects going
on. There we go. Hope that clears things up.
Probably not.
Keep did reading Becky's book. Yes, I did.
Okay, good. That's fine. That makes me feel better.
Robert, here's a question from Klaus about the stuff we send into space. And they say, I just read about India sending a solar observatory to the L1 Lagrange point. So I started thinking about how many things we can actually send to these points. A quick search told me that we have already parked quite a few objects out at L1 and L2, but can we keep doing that? I'm aware that while the Lagrange points might mathematically be points, they are probably more likely to be areas in reality, but how big are they? Also, do the different space agencies coordinate where they'll place objects in space, or could we someday risk something being sent to L2 and it end up blocking the view of the James Webb Space Telescope? Hope you can answer this bit of very practical thinking about space exploration.
Yeah, Klaus, well helpfully, as you know, although you're talking about a point, actually in practice what the missions do when they go there is they travel in an orbit around that point. And in the case of JWST, which is the one that we think of as the most recent famous example, I guess, that travels around the L2 point in an orbit that's actually hundreds of thousands of kilometers wide. I hadn't appreciated how big it is and needs to fire thrusters to stay in place. So there is a lot of space to play with. I mean, hundreds of thousands of kilometers is similar in size to the moon's orbit around the Earth. So very, very big volume of space to play around with. But despite that, there's actually some good sort of space station keeping and space management, because some of the missions have actually been moved away at the end of their life to prevent the very, very unlikely collisions. So WMAP, Herschel, Planck, and the Chinese mission Chang'e 2 were all moved into orbits around the sun to make that even less likely. So I think you don't have to worry about it in the same way that we do about collisions in low Earth orbit, which is very congested because you've got tens or hundreds of kilometers with perhaps by the end of the decade many hundreds of thousands of satellites there. And that's a real challenge for astronomy, as we've talked about before, as well as space junk and all the associated issues. But I think those missions out at L1 and L2, they're pretty safe.
Yeah,
and also like blocking the view of JWST, like JWST's view is very tiny.
I mean, the odds of that happening must be so vanishingly small. Yeah. And it would only be such a transient thing as well.
Yeah, it would be like a blink and you miss second. It pass in front of the view of JWST if something orbited near it even. But it's really cool when you see those like videos of, there's a video that ESA have done with the launch of the Euclid Space Telescope back in July, where they, because Euclid's gone to L2 as well, Gaia is also there orbiting L2 and JWST. So you've now got these three telescopes all in orbit around it. And it's really fun, like watching sort of like they leave the trace of the orbits on as well in the video. So it's almost like that game Spirograph.
Yeah, right?
Nice. And you just watch these orbits like build up around L2 and with all three of them just sort of like avoiding each other in this amazing dance. It's really cool.
I just don't think I'd appreciated how much space there is at L2. That's incredible. Yeah.
Well, because you can't keep something at L2 because you would also have to fire boosters. Like, yes, we call it stable, but at the same time, it would still sort of roll away from there.
Yeah.
So it's much more efficient to keep it in orbit.
And they do that every few weeks, don't they, with JWST at RED. It's quite often they have to adjust it to keep it there.
Yeah, exactly. So, because obviously it's moving as well as Earth moves. So that's the thing, is that it's actually more efficient to put stuff in orbit rather than try and keep them at what should be a stationary point if Earth and Sun were stationary, but they're not.
Okay, and Becky, can you answer this question from Sebastian? He says, hi, greetings from Oslo, and first of all,
hope you're getting some good aurora.
Exactly. First of all, thank you for producing the best astronomy podcast in the known universe, which I've eagerly been following since the first episode that already was rocking space, but never mind the change of name. So that's
Did
when
we
you
change
know
the name?
Yes.
Even I don't remember this.
Oh, Becky, it was a big moment in my life when we first launched as Nevermind the Space Rocks. And
I do remember this.
Anyway, we move on. Here is my cosmological question. What came first, the Big Bang or inflation? I grew up when the Big Bang was synonymous with whatever flashy moment that came first and had no yesterday, but have heard more recently that astronomers started putting inflation first on their diagrams diagrams representing the history of the universe, or rather remove the words Big Bang near that flash shown as inflation. So what is the Big Bang if not the first instant in time and if happening after inflation? Thanks again, Sebastian.
Thanks, Sebastian. Yeah.
You have 2 minutes, Becky. Go.
Okay. So I think the thing to get across is the Big Bang theory is not some moment or point in time of creation, although that pair of words has sort of entered the public psyche and begun to be used by people and also astronomers through the years as well as some moment of creation, which is technically not. So the Big Bang theory describes everything. So from the universe in its very hot and dense state to expanding to what we see today in the universe around us. That is the entire Big Bang theory. Inflation is just one part of the Big Bang theory, where the universe expanded at an exponential rate for an incredibly, incredibly short space of time. And it went from, it just expanded in size into numbers that even if I said them, you just wouldn't even comprehend how small and how big it went from and to, right? And it's just this very initial part of sort of that expansion of the universe. And so the reason you've probably seen this sort of like Big Bang being taken off these diagrams is because using the phrase Big Bang to mean sort of a moment of creation actually adds so much misunderstanding of how the universe sort of evolved and expanded that people have sort of corrected their sort of linguistic mistake where it's been picked up to mean this moment of creation and stopped sort of labeling like time equals zero as that, because that is not what the Big Bang is. The Big Bang theory is this evolution of the entire universe. And so when we think about sort of like what happened when the universe was much, you know, younger and it was in this hotter, denser state, our physics starts to break down, you know, 10 to the minus 36 seconds, you know, into the universe's history. So, you know, even then I wanted to say 10 to the minus 36 seconds after the Big Bang, because it's become so like used in sort of language, but that it's not what it means. So yeah, 10 to the minus 36 seconds into the universe's history is what I now, you know, try to say to be consistent with the idea of the Big Bang theory being everything.
Yeah, because I would actually say it's one of the questions we get sent the most of everything starting from a single point.
Yeah.
And I often respond like, we've done a whole episode on this, here you go. But it's interesting what impact that has throughout, you know, the more and more we look into and talk about astronomy. But
yeah, and so I guess if there's any like sort of language nerds out there, they'll be absolutely geeking out over this about how it entered, like the phrase entered like common language and then just got used in the wrong way and then has like, you know, sort of skewed people's understanding of it to the point where it's entered, like I'll read papers that have been published by astronomers that colloquially use like Big Bang as meaning like time equals zero, and it's just not right to use it in that way.
Very interesting. Well, thanks everyone, and keep the questions coming. You can email podcast@ras.ac.uk, tweet us @RoyalAstroSoc, and we're also on Instagram @SupermassivePod.
We'll be back next time with an episode about the multiverse. I mean, like Marvel. Look out, we're coming for you. But until next time, everybody, happy stargazing.